Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about whether or not the chances for cancellation of student loan debt have increased as of late, what it means for your strategy, why it's going to be a big mess, why I think it's going to create chaos with this looming legal battle over student loan cancellation that I think could be coming. This is pure speculation, but it's educated speculation. So I'm excited to talk about today's main topic, talk about a couple other things going on in the student loan world, and give you a little bit of a life update as to why we're having a lot of our consultants doing the podcast instead of me, which is the sort of the usual pace of things. But first, remember that as a listener, you can ask questions, and it's a great way to get free answers from me about whatever questions are pressing on your mind. So before we get into the main topic of today's show, I want to take two listener questions. Remember that you can ask your own question at studentloanplanner.com/voicemail on your mobile phone. So first, let's take a question from David.
Hey, Travis. If next year I decide to file married filing separate instead of married filing jointly like I did this year, and my married filing separate adjusted gross income is less than this year's married filing jointly adjusted gross income, is there a problem with that when it comes to recertifying my income next year when the question comes up, is your income decreased from the year before? And if I say yes, is that a red flag or some sort of problem that the servicer would then require me to provide additional documentation that could actually increase my student loan payment up significantly more than it would have otherwise?
Really interesting question, right? If you're filing jointly, there might be a lot of good reasons for that. One of the reasons might be the tax penalties associated with filing separately might be pretty high. If you're not in a community property state and your spouse made nothing, then you know there's not really a reason to file separately for taxes. You can just file jointly and get the same payment that you'd get if you filed separately. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why you might file jointly versus separately just in the first place. What this listener wants to know is, let's say he made $100,000 married filing jointly. And then now let's say he made, let me say $50,000, and let's say his spouse made $100,000, hypothetically, right? Well, obviously, $150,000 is greater than $100,000. And the difference between $50,000 and $100,000, you know, if you file separately for taxes, I'd have to run the numbers, but my guess is that tax penalty wouldn't be, you know, would not be close to the lower payment that you'd get by filing separately. But the question asks you on the form, right? It asks, has your income significantly decreased since you filed your last tax return? I know what this listener is asking. He says, well, yeah, it technically decreased because we're filing separately. So here's where I would fall on this. So what they're really asking is your current pay stub lower than your tax return? That's what they're really asking. Let's get to the heart of the question, right? Did this listener's income decrease if his married filing joint income was 100 last year and this year it's higher, but his separate income's lower? Well, the answer is no, his income did not decrease. His income as a couple increased. Do you see why that's a gray area? If his income increased, then he can file separately for taxes and answer, no, my income did not decrease to that question. And that's totally fine because you're answering that as a marital unit, even though you're filing married filing separately. The key here is to answer the question honestly in such a way that it's not going to create headaches and problems for you when you certify your income-driven repayments forms. So answer truthfully, but really try to ask yourself always, what is this question really trying to get at? Then that can help you when you're trying to interpret some of these sort of gray areas when it comes to the student loan rules. So great question. And now a question about the repay program from Sam.
Hi, Travis. I have a question about repay. I'm someone who is not pursuing PSLF. I'm a medical student and I matched and I'll be starting in July. My repay payments are $0 for the first year. If my interest is $1,000 per month and I hypothetically make payments of $500 with a minimum of zero, what happens to my government subsidy of my interest? Is it still the full $500 a month based on my minimum, or does it change because I'm making extra payments? And again, I am planning on paying off all of my loans myself financially, so I just want to decrease that interest as much as possible. Thank you.
So I'm glad that Sam made it very clear that she does plan to fully pay off her loans, right? That's the only time it would make sense to pay anything extra than your minimum monthly payment, just in general, regardless if you're going for PSLF or some other loan forgiveness program. This is a great question. It's basically saying, if my required payments are zero, but I want to kind of, you know, pay a little extra to keep my loan balance as low as possible while I'm in med school, does that hurt my interest subsidy? So for those of you that don't know, revised pay-as-you-earn covers 50% of all the interest that your required payment doesn't cover every month. So for example, if your required payment is zero, the interest subsidy is 50% of all of your interest. And the way that interest subsidy is kind of dealt out is on a monthly basis. So when you certify your income, they calculate your required payment, and then that interest subsidy is applied to your loans on a monthly basis for the next 12 months. Let's say Sam's required payment was $1,000 a month. Well, then $1,000 a month would fully cover all of her interest, and then there would be no interest left over to subsidize, so the interest subsidy in that case would be zero. If her required payment was $500 a month, like let's say she wasn't paying $500 a month because she wanted to, she was paying $500 a month because she had to because that was her repay payment, well, then the interest difference between $1,000 and $500 is $500, and so the government would cover 50% of that, which is $250. So that's how the repay subsidy works. It's, you know, I do this all the time, so, you know, sometimes I forget that people don't just study the definitions of student loans, right? So don't feel bad at all if you're not like an expert in that. What happens with that interest subsidy if she pays extra? The way the subsidy is applied is they figure out what your required payment is when you certify, and they tell you what it is, and then the subsidy on that monthly basis is dealt out every single month for those next 12 months, regardless of what you do. So if she paid $2,000 a month, then she would still get the interest subsidy of $500 a month. You can double check this, you can verify this, but this is the way we've always seen it applied. So what we would suggest to Sam is if she really feels strongly about paying an extra $500 a month on her loans, then yes, being on the repay program is smart. Doing a consolidation right after medical school is smart. To get that zero payment started 4 months sooner than if you take this full 6 month grace period. And then that extra payment is going to be applied first to any accruing interest. So actually that $500 a month is required to first go to the accruing interest, which in this case would be $500 a month. So basically she's going to keep her loan flat while she's in training, which is pretty good. I mean, that's certainly a good thing. The one sort of life, quality of life kind of thing that I would suggest to Sam is remember that the lowest income you're ever going to have is when you're a resident. I mean, if you're a dentist or a physician, right, the lowest income you'll ever have is when you're in training. And I applaud Sam for wanting to tackle throwing money at the loans to try to keep the balance from growing. But if she's on the repay program, the interest is not going to compound. It's just going to grow at a simple rate of interest. And also, you're only young once. So I was kind of talking about this to some of my friends the other day, saying like, wow, I kind of wish that when I was in my 20s, I wasn't such a cheapo. And I'm not saying that our listener Sam is. I'm saying that I was. So I shared a house with five guys and one bathroom. Like I lived in a quasi-finished basement. I drove a really old car. And if I had known that everything was going to be okay financially, I might have loosened the screws a little bit. So Sam, if you're able to make that $500 a month payment, by all means, go ahead. But if you are, you know, emerging from this pandemic like everyone else is, looking for where's that first airline ticket to an exotic location that I can travel to, you're going to be working your tail off in residency. So it's just really important to take care of your mental health and make sure you go on some nice trips too. And if you can do all those things and make your $500 a month payment on your loans, then by all means do it. But remember, putting money away for your, you know, emergency fund would come first. Before that, I would maybe say put $100 on your loans until your emergency fund is really solid. And then maybe you can tackle saving 5% for retirement, maybe $100 a month into a brokerage account. Make sure you have all of your vacations and the trips that you want to take planned, and then go take that extra money and you can put it on your loans. Great question. Now, I just want to do a little bit of a reaction to the state of the housing market, economy, inflation, labor market, just a whole bunch of things. So for those of you that don't know, I'm moving from St. Louis to the Research Triangle area, Raleigh-Durham in North Carolina. And as you would expect with a move, you do a housing hunt. You obviously need a place for your family to live. And so we kind of toured around the area. Absolutely everywhere, houses are getting snapped up in like 2 days. And you might ask, like, why is this? Well, there's this huge supply problem of houses. And I think that it's kind of a long time coming just because of all the different things that led up to this, right? So you kind of have restrictive zoning rules. You have all the things that usually tamp down the supply of houses. But then this global pandemic has put a massive premium on where you live. If you think about a normal economic time, what matters with your house? Well, your house, I mean, a lot of times you might only see it for like 3 hours of your waking day if you're working 12-hour days, right? I mean, think about it back when a lot of you were working, if you're a resident of some sort, you might only see your house when you're sleeping. It's not very interesting to spend a lot of money on a place that you're just going to see the bedroom and the TV for an hour a day, right? So with the pandemic, though, everybody's working from home. Everybody has all these travel restrictions where it's a lot harder to leave and go other places and have your house sitting empty while you're seeing those places, right? So the demand for housing has soared, and the demand for a very specific kind of housing has soared, which is spacious, backyard, extra rooms. That kind of house is just a lot more valuable in this kind of era that we're living in right now. And because so few people are able to, you know, get up and move, right? Especially older people during a pandemic, that's the last thing you want to think about is moving across the country. So there's a lot lower supply. And I was thinking too, if you're an older person until very recently, right, what do a lot of older people do? Well, they downsize. Well, you're not going to downsize unless you can feel pretty confident that you'll be able to buy a smaller house, right? Or you might sell your house and move into a nursing home or an assisted living facility. Well, guess what? During COVID, that's the last place that you want to go, is an assisted living facility or a nursing home, because of just that being the epicenter of the pandemic. So that's kind of one of the reasons why you've got way high demand on the housing side, and then the supply is very limited. So in the area that we were in Raleigh-Durham, they were saying typical is like 12,000 homes for sale, and they only have about 2,000 homes for sale in the whole metro area. So I want to give you my sympathy if you're kind of dealing with looking for housing yourself and not finding it. Obviously, I know what you're going through. We ended up renting a place just because that was just the best option. And it's kind of a weird market too with renting, because with the federal eviction moratorium, I guess the value is, I'm just going to speak plainly here, the value of having a high credit score is extremely valuable to from the landlord's perspective, because the landlord, I think, a lot of these landlords, I guess, are afraid of having somebody take the house and then not make payments for several months until the eviction moratorium is over. I think in this kind of a marketplace, if you're struggling to find housing, probably the best option, if you have a good credit score and you're patient and you don't have a rushed timeline, is probably to rent until the market normalizes a little bit. I could be wrong. There could be really bad inflation, and then housing prices today could actually look like a bargain. But I think that the prices of housing are already factoring in that the fact that there's already inflation, because here's what we know if we look around us. The government says that inflation is only 2.5% or something like that. We know that's, I mean, that might be the theoretical technical statistic, but we know that's ridiculous in practice. If you look around everywhere, there's massive inflation with housing, cars, rental car prices, lumber. I mean, you could really just go on and on and on. Another thing I'm seeing that I think we're going to start seeing is big inflation in wages. One of the things I noticed walking around some of the business districts, both in my hometown here, my current hometown of St. Louis, and in the place we're moving to, I like to just walk around and get a feel for what's going on in the neighborhood and what do I see on the windows of these dining establishments that we walk by and grocery stores, etc. Almost every single place had a sign on the door that said, "We're hiring," or "Now hiring." I mean, I went to go eat some of St. Louis's famous barbecue ribs at one of my favorite restaurants the other day, and their sales pitch was competitive wages, benefits, and then the third checkbox was, "And a free meal with every shift." And it's like, that makes sense. That would be maybe a reason why I would take a job at that place over another one. But if you think about what's going on, there is a massive shortage of supply in the labor market. So what does it take to fix that supply problem? Well, I think that one is higher wages. You're going to need to pay lower income people a higher income to incentivize more people to enter the labor force again. So when I was a bond trader, labor force participation rate was a major problem. Getting a, you know, that labor force participation rate higher was one of the key goals for the Federal Reserve and for policymakers, just because it had been trending down for a long time. So if we see higher wages, we might see people come back into the labor force. So that's something that we should all cheer for. I think another thing that's going to affect the supply of labor is when we have enhanced unemployment benefits expire, that will bring some people back into the labor force. I don't think it's necessarily going to be, you know, earth-shattering numbers of people. I think most people, if they see a job that they like, they're going to just go for it. There are some people out there that I think will wait until the end of the unemployment benefits expire. Well, I'm talking about the extra enhanced benefits where you get the extra few hundred dollars a week. Does it affect a ton of things? Probably not, but it does probably affect things at the margin. So that'll help labor supply, increased labor force participation. If we see increased wages, will affect it. But if we see businesses that are forced to raise wages to attract workers, they will pass along those costs to consumers in the form of higher prices. So why are student loan refinancing rates still low? I've been asking myself that question. I think it's mainly because the Federal Reserve is still pulling all the levers to keep interest rates really low so that we can have a roaring recovery. I think that's really what's going on. So the Federal Reserve has the biggest influence on interest rates, and the Federal Reserve has decided for now that they want to keep those interest rates low. And I guess, you know, other factors in the economy are such that it's keeping those rates from really rising super fast, at least as I recorded this. We had a couple weird things happen the past few weeks. We've had like a 8-figure amount refinanced with our student loan refinancing partners. So I think people are starting to kind of get the idea that, hey, there might be, you know, inflation in the near future and I might want to think about refinancing. I'm not sure if they'll still be offering it when I record this, but Common Bond was offering a 0% intro rate for 6 months and then a low fixed rate for a 20-year fixed rate option to allow people to refinance before the end of the student loan interest freeze expiration. So a lot of people took them up on that. I still think we're also seeing a lot of people continuing to refinance with our other partners as well. I mean, I've even seen fixed rates for 15 years starting with a 2-handle. You know, I've never seen that in my life. So there's really crazy low interest rates, and I don't know how long it's going to last. It might last for years. It might last for another month. I have no idea. So I think that if you're a slam dunk refinancing case with everything going on in the economy, I would probably apply, see if I can get one of these 0% APR deals just to lock in a low intro rate that's the same thing as the federal rates. And then I would refinance it again from a 20-year to maybe a 10-year once I've gotten more established and I feel comfortable with that monthly payment being a little bit higher, right? Remember the refinancing ladder? You're supposed to start off with a 20-year fixed, maybe do a 15-year or a 10-year, then do a 7, and then do a 5, and then finally a 5-year variable. And you can pick up a refinancing bonus every single time as long as you're using a new company and you're applying through studentloanplanner.com/refi. Obviously, if you're going for forgiveness, you shouldn't worry about that at all. You shouldn't worry about paying back your loans, that is. If anything, I hope that, you know, I feel like I've been vindicated a little bit versus the anti-debt, quote-unquote, student loan experts of the world with all of this stuff that has happened. I mean, forgiveness has held up. Forgiveness benefits have gotten more generous, not less generous. We've seen signaling from policymakers about their potential of eliminating the student loan tax on forgiveness, right, for the private sector version of forgiveness with the American Recovery Plan, just sliding in that 5-year window for tax-free student loan forgiveness that expires in the mid-2020s, signaling that we might have that become a permanent feature after that. People's income-based repayments, obviously over the past year, more than a year, have been suspended, but still getting credit towards those student loan forgiveness programs. So the whole student loan forgiveness isn't real. It's not a thing. You know, you have to pay back your debt. You borrowed it. You need to pay it back. I mean, let me go pull out the world's smallest violin for those folks. Yes, it absolutely makes sense to pay back your debt if it makes sense. Like, you got to look at the numbers. If it makes sense, awesome. Pay back your debt. Side hustle your way to debt freedom. Whatever cliche you want to use about debt repayment, right? Eat your beans, eat your rice, pay it all off. But if you are going for forgiveness, don't be scared. Don't be sad. Don't be anxious about it. It's going to work. I think there's so many more things to be anxious about that don't include student loans, right? It's like, am I ever going to be able to afford a house? I mean, like, one kind of scary thing is somebody kind of talked about how all these pension funds and Wall Street private equity firms are buying up all these houses because they're just anticipating millennials are just going to have to rent forever. I mean, whenever you see stories like that, yeah, there's some truth to it, which is why they're writing the story. But also don't let yourself get pulled into that. It's kind of like a sucker story, like, oh, millennials are never going to own homes. Homeownership rate among millennials as a generation might be significantly lower than that of our parents, but plenty of people will still own a home. And the other thing that I'll say is ownership isn't everything. If the economics of homeownership don't make sense, then you shouldn't own a home. Like, there's a lot of places around the world where owning a home is like kind of dumb just because it's just overpriced relative to rents. And so if you get the benefit of living in the house and you don't have a psychological need to own a home so you can paint the walls the color that you want, then there's no reason why you need to own a home. I try having this discussion with my wife and she's like, yeah, I want to own a home. So if you are in a relationship where one spouse kind of wants a house or partner wants a house and one doesn't, that's okay. Like, maybe you negotiate over timeline. So for us, you know, we're going to rent for several months, just kind of keep our ear to the ground, just kind of see what happens with housing supply and see if we're able to be opportunistic in the winter when hopefully the pandemic has subsided and we have a little bit more normal world we're living in with supply and demand of things. So that's just some thoughts about just the general economy. Remember that, you know, this is just an educated guess and that it's totally fine. Like, it's going to work out fine. You know, we've seen a lot worse economic shocks than what we've been through with this pandemic. And it's kind of really surprising to me back in, like, think about a year ago or more than a year ago, like in April of 2020, we thought the sky was falling. And now we're talking about how much is random video game stock going to go to the moon. I mean, it's just a really weird world we're living in, isn't it? So now I kind of monologued about that a little bit longer than I planned to. I want to talk about the main topic of today's podcast, which is going to be the probability of cancellation is increasing. And I'll explain why in a second. The first big news that I think we need to really talk about for student loans today, it's the new high probability that we are going to see attempted student loan cancellation. However, I still think that there's a good chance that it actually might not go through. So we've had this appointment of Richard Cordray, who is the former director of the CFPB. He is an ally of Senator Elizabeth Warren, and he is a staunch progressive. And he's going to be the head of the student loan system now because Secretary Cardona, the Secretary of Education, recently appointed him to that position. So this is a major victory for progressives. This is a huge deal. And let me explain why. Usually the head of the Federal Student Aid Office is kind of like a technocratic position, or it's kind of a sleepy position where you appoint somebody that they're not going to be an obvious partisan. They're probably going to be aligned with you, but it's not going to be really obvious probably that they're aligned with you. So for example, if you just go back and look at who's held this position in the past, you know, it was a retired Air Force general under President Trump. I think it's, again, more of kind of a technocratic type person under prior presidents. But Richard Cordray is a clear Democrat. He actually ran to be governor of Ohio, I think, as a Democrat. So the fact that this position is now essentially a political appointee, you can see this on Twitter. So I'm going to read you a couple of reactions to the appointment of Richard Cordray to be the head of the student loan office on Twitter. So Elizabeth Warren says, Richard Cordray was a fearless CFPB leader who forced big financial institutions to return $12 billion to people they cheated. I'm very glad he'll be protecting student loan borrowers and bringing much-needed accountability to the federal student loan program. So that's from Elizabeth Warren. Cordray talked about Rohit Chopra, who is the former student loan ombudsman who now is running the CFPB or will be running the CFPB. Cordray says, we have a close working relationship already. So in many ways, I think this is a perfect opportunity for us to make very good progress forward and thinking about how we finance and make higher education available in the United States for people for whom it's more and more a critical step forward in their lives. Representative Jayapal, who is one of the sort of leaders, the progressive leaders, you know, you hear it in the news sometimes called the squad, right? So I believe she's one of those sort of original members. So she said on Twitter that Cordray's appointment is a, quote, big, big deal and major win for progressives on the issue of student debt. On the Republican side, you can see what I mean about this being viewed as a political appointment, because you usually don't see reaction like this, both positive and negative. You don't see this kind of reaction for this position usually. So Representative Fox, who is the ranking Republican on the House Education Committee, says, quote, a $1.5 trillion student loan portfolio requires savvy financial management. This is her speaking. I am skeptical that a failed Democrat politician who has a history of getting consumed by politics instead of caring for consumers has the capability and serious character required to carry out the duties of chief operating officer of FSA. The leaders of the Student Loan Servicing Trade Group and the Consumer Bankers Association CEO took more conciliatory notes, obviously knowing that they're going to be having to deal with, I don't know if you'd call Director Cordran, I'm not sure what his title would be, but this Richard Hunt person who's the CEO of the Consumer Bankers Association said, quote, for too long, politicians have ignored the root causes of the federal student debt crisis and students and families have suffered. I hope Mr. Cordray can reverse this trend, right? So in other words, the trade and industry groups are jockeying to have the conciliatory note because they know that they're going to needing to be working with Cordray. The progressives in Congress are extremely excited about this pick. The Republicans are deeply disappointed. So what does that mean for you and for your student loans? Let's think about it a little bit. Senator Warren is probably the biggest proponent of what I would call realistic student loan cancellation out there. What I mean by realistic student loan cancellation is when Senator Sanders and Senator Warren were running for president, Senator Sanders' position was very pure. Forgive it all, cancel it all. Senator Warren had a very detailed plan where it was going to be limited based on income. You were only going to be able to get $50,000 canceled. In other words, it was designed so that the majority of the benefit would not go to the wealthiest borrowers. Because if you cancel student loan debt for everyone, that would be wonderful for the people listening to this. But that would primarily benefit people making higher incomes that have the highest debts that tend to have more professional degrees, right? Because somebody that's a Starbucks barista would get $10,000 of cancellation and somebody that went to dental school would get $500,000 of cancellation. I mean, it's progressive, but maybe it's not too. I mean, there's a really good argument for both sides of it, that it's progressive or it wouldn't be progressive. It's kind of interesting. If we think about Senator Warren being the proponent of what I call realistic cancellation, in other words, what realistic cancellation is targeted cancellation. It's kind of interesting. We did a survey of our audience and we said, you know, what do you think about student loan cancellation? Only 32%, and I say only, that's a pretty big number though, but about a third of people, 32%, said that they were in favor of canceling all of it. 68% were not in favor of canceling all of it. However, 85% of people were in favor of canceling some of it. So the vast majority of student loan borrowers think that there should be some cancellation. They just don't think that it should necessarily go benefit everyone. So we have an ally of Senator Warren now leading the student loan program. There's a legal review going on with the Department of Education and Department of Justice on whether the president has the authority to cancel student debt or not. I remember when a lot of the folks were getting appointed to the legal office at the Department of Ed, it was a lot of progressives. It was a surprise to progressives how many progressives were included in the legal team there. There's a lot of good arguments about why the president can cancel student loan debt. One of them is that they've already done it. Two different presidents of two different parties have already canceled $100 billion of student loan debt because they did so without congressional authorization after the CARES Act, you know, expired September 2020. You know, that was the end of the congressional authorization of suspending payments and interest, right? What happened is, you know, when President Trump lost the election, I think his team realized what he had sort of teed up for President Biden to potentially do. And so you saw a legal memo come out of the Department of Ed the last second saying the reason he had this authority was because he was operating under the, I think it was the HEROES Act of 2003, which gives the president the authority to basically, you know, make sure that student loan borrowers are no worse off at the end of a national emergency as they were at the beginning, which is basically the authorization. That's where they're saying the authorization comes to suspend the principal payments and the interest on student loans, not this broad authority that I'll mention in a second from the Higher Education Act. It's kind of these things where I am not a legal person. I am not a lawyer. I want to make sure that I give adequate respect to the legal world out there. But I remember talking to some of my friends who are bankruptcy attorneys with student loans, and a lot of times, you know, he said that he would bring the exact same case before a judge. One judge was a member of the local yacht club, and a pretty conservative Republican, and the judge would come back and say, you know, this person needs to pay this back. There's not going to be any cancellation. And then he would bring the same case to somebody who was a former defense attorney, civil rights volunteer or something like that, with, you know, Association for Civil Rights or something. And that judge would come back and say, yes, there's going to be cancellation, or there's going to be, you know, settlement that we'll authorize. So it's sort of like this thing where people's views do kind of color the legal outcomes of things, right? I mean, that's just reality. To say otherwise, I think, is just to suspend reality. So what do I think is going to happen? I think that the legal review, you know, and this could be totally wrong if they come out with the answer before this podcast gets released, but I think what will happen is that you will see a legal review that will come out that says President Biden has the authority from the Higher Education Act to cancel as much student debt as he wants to cancel. They might say it's because of the pandemic, but I think they're going to come out and say that he has the authority to do it. And remember, this is a group of progressives in the Department of Education that are putting this together, that they're going to come up with a legal justification to do it. President Trump's very conservative group of people, right before he left the administration, left the White House, said the exact opposite. And so you've got two different memos from the Department of Education from two different administrations saying conflicting things. And so let's say that they come back and say that President Biden can do it. Then does the Department of Education decide how much to cancel? If the Department of Education decides how much to cancel, I think they might ask for 50,000 instead of 10,000, because you have an ally of Senator Warren leading the student loan program now. Will President Biden be the one to get that authority? It's hard to say. It's really setting up for a lot of chaos, because here's where this gets challenged. There was this case that cited a whole lot as to why the president does not have the authority to cancel student loans. So in the Higher Education Act, the Secretary of Education can, and I'm quoting, modify, compromise, waive, or release any right, title, claim, lien, or demand, however acquired, including any equity or right of redemption. Lawyers interpret that to mean that you can cancel as much student loan debt as you want. However, opponents of that interpretation say that this authority is limited because the preamble to the Higher Education Act says that this power for the Secretary of Education is respect to the powers vested by this part. So in other words, what they say that means is, yes, the Secretary of Education can cancel things, but only to the extent that Congress deems it's appropriate, from programs like public service loan forgiveness, teacher loan forgiveness, etc. You know, the moderate view is really the one taken by President Biden, which is that he's not sure he can do it via executive order and wants it to come out as an act of Congress. Because I think that he knows that you would see a very vigorous legal challenge to student loan cancellation via executive order. And the reason is because it doesn't need to be paid for. And I'll get into why that is in a second. There's this case called Whitman versus American Trucking Association. The most famous line out of that case is that Congress does not hide elephants in mouse holes. The idea behind that is, did Congress, with an oversight, you might say, of how they wrote the law, give the authority to the Secretary of Education to wipe out $1.5 trillion of federal student loans that's owned by technically the American people, right? Or the ones that own this debt as if it's an asset. So if you can just cancel all $1.5 trillion, that's a major power. I mean, you could say that's like the biggest power of any secretary, you know, for any department, really, if you think about it. Canceling $1.5 trillion of student debt for everyone all at once without needing to pay for it. I mean, that's a tremendous power if you have that power. The idea there is that, you know, certainly Congress, when they wrote the Higher Education Act in 1965, certainly Congress did not anticipate that giving the Secretary of Education the authority to cancel over $1 trillion, right? I think that, you know, anybody can say that. The question is, the way the statute's written in such a way where the Secretary of Education can wipe it all away. I mean, this is a thing that's like, it's a legal question. And if you get an answer that's not what the Republicans want, they're going to challenge it. And they're going to challenge it probably all the way. My guess is, here's how it would go. Cordray and Secretary Cardona decide to cancel the student debt after the legal review that finds President Biden can do it. Obviously, they're either going to go for 10K or 50K. They might make it targeted to make it a little bit more palatable, or to make it a little bit less susceptible, you could say, to a legal challenge. But with stacking the student loan program with progressives, I don't necessarily know if you're going to see that be a modest cancellation. They might try to go for it all. But here's the problem, though. If you're a Republican legal opponent of this, what would you do? You would probably take this in front of a sympathetic judge and get a stay on the cancellation order so that they don't process it first. Because if you process it first, it'd be pretty hard to bring it all back. So you get the stay, and then you take it to the Supreme Court. Maybe it gets expedited because of the sensitivity of the timing of all this. You need to know, do you owe it or not? And so then this gets taken all the way to the Supreme Court. What do you think the 6-3 Supreme Court conservative majority would say about the executive's power to wipe away $1.5 trillion or even hundreds of billions of dollars of student loan debt without congressional authorization? My guess is they would be saying that that would not be something that could be done via the executive. The chances that we will see cancellation come out of the executive branch are significantly higher now than they've been. But the problem is I still think it's most likely they'll try to do 10,000 for everyone, but they could do 50 now just because of the team that's running this. But if they do that, especially if they do 50, because that would be a massive bill. That would be like $900 billion. That's almost $1 trillion that somebody is canceling that, you know, I mean, that would be a big deal, right? So I think that you will see a vigorous legal challenge to any cancellation efforts that come out of the executive branch. The way you could do this is cancel it, but then it wouldn't actually even impact the deficit because of accounting conventions. We know that the repayment rate assumptions for student loans are flawed. We know that because of smart strategies that you can take to pay a lot less on your student loans, you can pay a lot less than you're forecasted to pay because, you know, they're not modeling people getting help from professionals like us at Student Loan Planner to help you pay less money towards your student loans legally. That wasn't kind of in the game plan that people would file separately and save for retirement and live in community property states, right? And do all these things that you can legally do to pay less. So it's kind of interesting with accounting conventions with this because the accounting conventions for student loan cancellation, if you do it through the executive branch, it doesn't need to be paid for. If you do it through Congress, it does need to be paid for. I have no idea why they did it this way. Just know that in Congress, there's this thing called offsets. Offsets require you to pay for something either through tax increases or through lowering spending somewhere else. That's very unappealing to raise $300 billion or $900 billion of taxes or cut spending that much to cancel student loan debt. It's basically politically kind of almost a non-starter. I mean, you could do it, but then all of a sudden, like, it runs the cost of the bill up so high that it's just so easy to attack politically. You might disagree with that, but I mean, I think that this American Families Plan, the infrastructure plan, if they put student loan cancellation in that, I think that, you know, you would see more opposition from that than you would otherwise because you're talking about pushing the price tag over $2 trillion. You know, in that case. So that would make the number optically appear not attractive. You don't appoint a progressive champion to run the student loan program if you're going to take moderate, small, tinkering around the edges type of actions. I think that the most obvious path they're going to do is they're going to go after the servicers really hard. They're going to make Navient and FedLoan public enemy number one, and, you know, for good reason. Right? I mean, they've certainly not done a good job managing the programs at all. We know that. But I just kind of, and they'll also go after for-profit colleges. They'll try for cancellation. They'll attempt a whole lot. But I guess color me cynical a little bit. Like, I think that no matter if they had appointed a moderate Democrat or progressive Democrat or a, you know, moderate Republican or conservative Republican to this role, it seems like not a whole lot changes. The student loan crisis continues to get worse. The issue is that the kind of Republican-leaning people don't necessarily go after the servicers and the for-profit colleges like they should. The Democratic-leaning people that are appointed to these roles don't go after the not-for-profit colleges. They don't go after the cost of education as much as they should, right? So I think both sides kind of have a problem with true accountability for the cost of higher education. I mean, imagine if we do have a medical debt problem in this country. It was a lot worse before the ACA. But imagine if we had, I don't know, tons of people that owed a ton of medical debt and your solution was, well, let's cancel it. Well, that kind of helps with the symptoms, but it didn't help at all with the cause, right? Because the problem is that you know, an MRI costs $40,000, right? The problem is not that the debt exists. The problem is how did it get that way in the first place? Fix that. And then you target, how do we get relief to people that are struggling with this terrible problem that was invented? So I guess that's kind of my concern about the cancellation, is I kind of see it as a giant distraction. Because will it help people? Yes, it will. It would tremendously help somebody that's got $10,000 that didn't finish their degree. And, you know, should that person get cancellation? Yeah. But I'm just concerned that the cancellation is sort of like an easy, look what we're doing, we care about people kind of path that really requires a really difficult solution. I mean, it's not a bumper sticker problem where you can just say, I support blah, blah, blah. It's really complicated. Like, schools overcharge. Schools have captured the system a little bit so that they are able to charge as much as possible. Apparently, the Grad Plus program and the Parent Plus program kind of got started with people borrowing unlimited sums, partly because the stupid accounting conventions made it look like all of the future profits were going to be so much bigger on the Grad Plus and the Parent Plus loans than the unsubsidized Stafford loans for the undergrads out there. So these really higher interest rate loans that are unlimited in terms of the borrowing amount, those showed huge profits to people, to the government, that is. And so they were really incentivized to loosen the rules on those to allow more people to borrow under the PLUS programs, which are unlimited. And yet we know that those loans are the kind of loans that the Department of Education is going to lose the most money on, because more people will disproportionately get those forgiven than pay them back, especially for these graduate school and Parent PLUS loans. So I just think there's just going to be all kinds of unintended consequences regardless of what they do. I mean, I can be hopeful that they'll bring more accountability to the programs. I hope that they will bring the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. They will help fix that for a lot of the people that try to do the right thing, were told the wrong thing by their loan servicer, were told they had qualifying loans when they did not. I mean, these are real problems. Right? These are real problems that do need to get fixed. But we're going to see. I think another big piece of news that came out a couple weeks ago, Secretary Cardona was asked very pointedly with this meeting from the Education Writers Association, and they asked, are you going to start payments again in October? He basically said that while they're going to look at the situation, look at the data, and they would consider making it go longer than that, he said, as of now, it's September 30th. So that implies very strongly the Department of Education is going to restart payments and interest October 1st. I think that they will try to look at the student loan situation to try to maybe try to cancel something before that date. I'm not sure. I would anticipate this legal review of the president's authority over student loan cancellation will be finished before September 30th. So that they can potentially attempt to take some action prior to September 30th. That'll be really interesting to follow. If we see some movement on cancellation before September 30th, that wouldn't surprise me at all. But I would also not be surprised at all if we didn't immediately see a stay and then a legal challenge and then have it be blocked. It's just going to create chaos for people. I don't know. I mean, we obviously as a country don't seem to be doing a lot of things with two-party support, and maybe this will sort of become the new norm. We'll have cancellation under a Democratic administration, then a Republican administration might try to make repayment terms worse for borrowers. I don't know. But I'm going to be here for you. We're going to be here for you with Student Loan Planner. We're going to try to interpret what we think will happen. I want you to know that we're not taking a position on what kind of cancellation should happen or whatever, right? Our job is to just help you through the mess. That's the way I look at it. Sometimes people will ask me, you know, will you lobby for this thing or that thing when it comes to student loans? I would highly encourage you to lobby for what you think should happen with the system. I always love hearing from readers and listeners about like what questions they have about like proposed fixes they have to the problem, right? Because that's a role that I think you as a student loan borrower absolutely should be advocating for. You should advocate for cancellation or for regulating schools or for lowering interest rates or making the programs more generous or eliminating the tax bomb. Like those are all things that you should do. I think that is better coming from you as a student loan borrower versus us as a for-profit company. That's just kind of my philosophy when it comes to this stuff. But I mean, if you're somebody that's been hoping for cancellation, Certainly, you would be excited about Cordray getting appointed to lead the student loan program. I think that if you are a PSLF borrower that's a physician that was hoping for an extension longer than September 30th for the payment and interest freeze, you'd be a little disappointed this past week. And if you're a lover of chaos, you know, if you're the Joker, then you're real excited because, you know, we'll probably end up seeing a big legal showdown over the legality of student loan cancellation from the executive branch. And I'm not looking forward to all the emails I'm going to get. So just know that if you want to book a plan, we're really active doing that right now. I am personally taking the month of May and June away from doing student loan consultations just to help the family move. I'm going to be back into the swing of things in July, but our team is doing the normal volume of student loan consultations right now. Lauren, Megan, Rob, Dan, and Molly, they're all very busy during this time preparing people for what repayment program to be on, what consolidation to do if you're graduating this spring, what tax filing strategy to do, all kinds of normal things that we see come up with the student loan program they're addressing right now. So if you need help from one of our student loan consultants, studentloanplanner.com/help. We're also doing a lot of follow-up plans for folks that we have talked to 1, 2, or even 3, 4 years ago, which is kind of cool. So if you're an existing client and you need a follow-up plan, reach out to us and we'll get you set up with one of those too. And then finally, remember earlier on the show, I talked about inflation risk. So definitely if you're somebody that thinks that, hey, I'd like to lock in a lower interest rate, certainly send us an email, help@studentloanplanner.com, if you want to ask questions about that. And then finally, remember that studentloanplanner.com/voicemail link that you can leave a question for our show to highlight. So I hope that you have a tremendous month of May. Remember, May is Mental Health Awareness Month. It's also Asian American and Pacific Islander Month. If you're struggling at all with mental health, make sure you go invest in one of these online counseling programs. I think they're really helpful. Remember the 1-800-273-TALK. If you or a loved one ever has any kind of suicidal ideation at all, call that phone number. It's pretty helpful. Don't be afraid or stigmatized by mental health. It's something that, you know, basically everybody has anxiety now just because of the year that we've been through. So don't feel ashamed at all from that. And, you know, half of people almost said that they had felt depression at some point due to their student loan debt. That's brutal. So don't feel like you're alone if you're going through that. So know that you are a very valuable person. You are a very important person, and you deserve to invest in yourself and get the help that you deserve if you're going through any of these mental health challenges. And then to our Asian American listeners out there, my wife's actually Asian American. There's obviously been a lot of incidents that have happened in the past several months that have been really difficult to watch. I certainly watch a lot of my wife shows me a lot of the attacks that have happened on Asian Americans, and we really want to first recognize and acknowledge that, but also recognize that, you know, Asian Americans, especially people that came recently to the country, or parents might have, or grandparents might have, they tend to have less financial assets than somebody that's been in the country a lot longer, right? So that's the case. My wife's second generation, she had to borrow for her student loans. One of the reasons was because her parents came to the country and then had to focus on just putting together financial security for their own family, and they didn't have decades and decades and, you know, an inheritance of assets from prior generations to build off of to avoid having to have her borrow a whole lot for medical school. So that's one of the reasons why we have certainly a very disproportionate group of Asian American borrowers that are clients of ours, is because of that very reason. I think you know, you really see this with a lot of different communities for different reasons, like LGBTQ communities sometimes not accepted by their family, often have to turn to student loans to fund education at a higher rate. You know, obviously underrepresented minorities, African-American, Hispanic communities have to turn to student loans because of a lack of generational wealth compared to white Americans. And obviously, if you're Caucasian and you didn't have wealthy parents, you have to turn to the student loan program too. So, but wanted to highlight those two special things happening in the month of May for our community. So thank you so much for letting me have the Travis Rant episode. We're going to have a lot of really awesome guests on the podcast in the next couple months. We're going to have a lot of a heavy dose of our student loan consultants on the show, which I'm excited about. And just know that this is going to be the summer to remember. I hope so, right? Like, I hope things are going to get back to normal. I hope everyone can take a special trip, plan a really awesome vacation, And just, you know, if there's anything the past year has shown us is we should just really try to enjoy life as much as we can, because you don't know what, you know, if you're guaranteed tomorrow. So thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Get out there and love life. Thank you, everyone.